Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
President Trump's name will reportedly be printed on the front of paper checks for coronavirus relief payments, which would be the first time the president's name has appeared on an IRS refund. President Trump's name, however, still has yet to appear on a check to the IRS.
Recorded from locations that are not 30 Rockefeller Plaza, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. On today's show, Seth chats with MSNBC's Chris Hayes. But first, a closer look.
And now, even after ignoring those warnings, the president is pushing to prematurely reopen the economy, threatening to repeat the same mistakes he made at the start of this crisis. For more on this, it's time for a closer look. When Donald Trump was elected in 2016, this was exactly the kind of nightmare scenario everyone was afraid of. What would happen in a global crisis if the most powerful man in the world was a racist game show host who's failed at virtually everything in his life except for pretending to be a successful businessman on TV? And he's not even good at pretending. I mean, look at him pretending to be president. He just stares directly into the camera and he can't even be bothered to at least put some fake documents on his desk. You can almost hear the dial tone blasting out of the phone. He looks like a tourist taking a photo on the set of Deep Impact.
Wow, is this the phone Morgan Freeman used? You know, everyone freaked out about the asteroid in that movie, but it ended up being no worse than the common everyday flu.
The point is, this is the crisis everyone feared. In fact, before Trump took office, President Obama's outgoing team tried to prepare Trump's incoming team for this exact scenario. A scenario experts had warned about for years.
Days before Donald Trump took office, some of President Obama's advisors walked the incoming president's team through a hypothetical scenario remarkably like the one we are living through now. It was a briefing on what would happen if a quick-spreading virus were to race through London and Seoul. And in that scenario, they presented governments imposing travel bans. There were shortages at hospitals across the country. And today, roughly two-thirds of those Trump administration officials who participated in that simulation are no longer in government.
That's right. Most of the Trump officials who worked for him back then aren't even there anymore. They're either in jail, on Fox News, or in the bargain bin at a Barnes & Noble. Hi, excuse me, this Sean Spicer book only has blank pages? Huh. Look at that. I guess you're the first person to ever open one. This White House has more staff turnover than a Six Flags over summer break. They even made the Six Flags mascot commerce secretary. What Obama's team should have done is run a simulation for what would happen when a sociopath president dismisses repeated warnings from intelligence officials and public health experts that a pandemic is coming and fires anyone who's done any planning for it. Okay, so the first thing you'd do in that case is you'd call up Netflix and you'd get them to release an emergency bonus episode of Tiger King ASAP. You know, think of it as a, I don't know, a where are they now situation, you know? Maybe someone got new teeth. And again, you know, obviously let's pray it never comes to this. In fact, as we've now learned, one former Trump official, Homeland Security Advisor Tom Bossert, was part of a group of people trying to warn the government in a series of exchanges called the Red Dawn emails. The emails were nicknamed after the 1984 Patrick Swayze movie, but if you're going to pick a Swayze movie, I feel like Ghost would have been a better choice since the government's response is clearly being led by one. I mean, yikes. Look at him. Jared Kushner looks like he just appeared out of nowhere after someone read an Edgar Allan Poe story into a cracked mirror and then demanded you pay for the mirror. It's weird that the public health response is being led by a guy who looks like he would sneak into your hospital room and pinch your IV line closed until you told him where the microfilm was.
It's a simple question.
So in those Red Dawn emails, we found out that Bossert and others had expressed concerns about Trump's slow and incoherent response. Like, for example, when Trump announced a hasty and confusing European travel ban that led to jam-packed airports in cities like Chicago after there were already documented cases of community spreading here in the U.S., Bossert wrote, "Can anyone justify the European travel restriction scientifically? Seriously, is there any benefit? I don't see it, but I'm hoping there is something I don't know." That's how we all feel, but it's never the case. With Trump, things are always exactly as they seem. For example, we see him using every muscle in his face to squint at the teleprompter like he's staring at a magic eye poster and say, "I think the president can't see, but I'm hoping there's something I don't know." And then you tune into his unhinged Rose Garden press conference Tuesday night, in which he announced in the middle of a global pandemic that he was pulling funding from the World Health Organization. And you see this.
"I instructed my team to use the Defense Production Act, and the Defense Production Act was used very powerfully. All of the aid that we send will be discussed at very, very powerful letters. We see light. We're starting to see it more than ever before. We've held our rate, the numbers, everything we've done, we've been very, very strong on it and very powerful on it."
He sounds like a guy on a date getting lines through an earpiece and the feed just cut out.
"The light in your eyes is so, it's so, well, it's lighty. I mean, they're your eyes, you know."
Also, I like when his brain melts, his go-to words are strong and powerful. It's like listening to a focus group on advertising for pickup trucks. "Okay, folks, what are some words that might make you want to buy a Ford F-150?
Strong, powerful, very powerful. That'd be another word for me, if you want to put that down for me."
And by the way, that's the guy news networks have decided to air unfiltered during a national emergency, the guy who can't even read his own script. If that's the kind of content you want, cable networks, just take a live feed of my grandpa at his next eye exam. And by the way, it doesn't make it better when you give it a negative chyron like CNN did on Monday with angry Trump turns briefing into propaganda session. You know what else turned that into a propaganda session? Pointing your camera at it. Before you showed up, it was just crazy lawn man does his thing. You can't air a propaganda session and criticize it. It's like if MTV had aired Jersey Shore with the disclaimer, "Change the channel. This show sucks." And that is what it was, a propaganda session. In fact, the White House edited together a campaign-style video highlighting Trump's various statements about the crisis, and Trump actually had people inside your government, paid with your tax dollars, make that video.
"Ask about the video, because I've never seen a video like that played in this room. It looks a bit like a campaign ad. Who produced that video for you?"
"That was done by a group in the office."
"This was produced here in the White House."
"Yeah, was done by Dan and a group of people."
Oh, it was done by Dan? And a group of people? First of all, it's funny that it was only Dan who got named and everyone else who was complicit in this bull got lumped into a group of people. Trump knows how to accidentally shame someone by giving them credit for something terrible.
Dan, do you want to come up here and talk about the propaganda video you made with taxpayer dollars? You're shaking your head no, Dan. Dan, do you want to come up here? Dan, show everyone your face and take credit for this thing you did. Dan? No? Fauci? How about you, Fauci? You want to say a few words about Dan?" "Made you touch your face again, Fauci. This guy. I love you, Fauci."
Particularly, Trump keeps touting his ban on travel from China, but according to experts, the ban only served to buy the White House time to ramp up testing and hospital capacity and start community mitigation efforts, time they wasted. And when he was asked to explain what he did with all that time in February, Trump decided to get into a fight with the reporter Paula Reed of CBS, who asked the question.
Thousands of lives by
putting time that you bought. The argument is that you bought yourself some time. You didn't use it to prepare hospitals. You didn't use it to ramp up testing. Right,
you're
now,
so, you're so, 20 million you're so people disgraceful. Are unemployed. It's so disgraceful the way you say that. Let me just listen. I just went over it. I just went over it.
In an unprecedented crisis.
Nobody thought we should do it. And when I did it.
But what did you do with the time that you bought?
You know
the
we
month
did?
Of February. That, you that know video we did? Was a gap.
What do you do?
Month of February.
What do you do when you have no case in the whole United States?
You had cases
when
in
you,
February.
You, excuse me. You reported it. Zero cases, zero deaths on January 17th.
January. February. The entire
January.
Month of February,
I said in January.
Your video has a complete gap.
On January 30th.
What did your administration do in February with the time that your travel ban botched?
A lot.
What?
A lot. And in fact, we'll give you a list.
Dan, can you get us that list you made of everything we did in February? You're shaking your head no, Dan, but I know you have a list of everything we did in February that this lady's asking me about. The February list, Dan. It'll be between the January list and then the March list. Dan, don't make me tell everyone your last name, Dan. It's Scavino.
Also, thank you for reminding Trump to his face that there are real-world consequences here for the thousands who have died. And their loved ones, the nearly 20 million who've lost their jobs, the millions who've lost their health insurance, the courageous healthcare professionals putting themselves in danger on the front line, and all the essential workers delivering mail and packages and working at grocery stores and on public transit and doing all the hard, dangerous work while the rest of us surf to the bottom of Netflix looking for another trashy reality show to watch. Honey, have we watched Island yet? Oh, right. Yeah, we did. Oh, wait. Honey, there's a new bonus episode. Oh, they got divorced, honey. Yeah. I guess once the couples got back from the mainland, they realized the connections they made on Island weren't as enduring as they'd been led to believe. I guess romance is dead, honey. And now Trump is once again rushing to prematurely reopen the economy, even though public health experts have nearly unanimously warned that such a move could lead to a second wave of the outbreak. Dr. Fauci warned about this on Sunday. Bill Gates said we won't go back to normal until there's a vaccine. Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel said concerts, conferences, and sporting events likely won't return until fall 2021 at the earliest. And a Harvard study said yesterday some social distancing measures may be needed until 2022. So, yeah, I'm going to have to rewatch every episode of Island with the director's commentary on.
You know, we were originally going to do it on an isthmus, but we thought isthmus was too hard to say, so we went with an island.
And yet, our split personality president has, in a matter of days, gone back and forth between claiming he has unquestioned authority to unilaterally force states to reopen their economies to suggesting he'll simply work with states to allow them to implement their own plans.
There's a debate over what authority you have to order the country reopen. What authority do you
have? Well, I have the ultimate authority. The president of the United States has the authority to do what the president has the authority to do, which is very powerful. The president of the United States calls the shots. I have the absolute right to do if I want to. This is when somebody's the president of the United States, the authority is total. And that's the way it's got to be.
The authority is total.
It's total. It's total.
Again, I think part of the problem here is Trump only knows like three words, which include absolute, powerful, and total. He uses the word total the way teenagers use the word random.
My authority is like so total.
President and his allies ignored repeating warnings that a pandemic was coming, and now in the face of that evidence, he's pushing to prematurely reopen the economy and repeat all the same mistakes over again. When the time for an accounting comes, we must remember that this was not inevitable and that a long sequence of failures led to this moment. And if you have trouble remembering,
we'll give you a list.
This has been A Closer Look.
Do you ever feel like you're settling? For your foundation, that is. Maybelline's new Instant Age Rewind Eraser Foundation doesn't settle into fine lines and wrinkles. With SPF 20 and moisturizing Pro Vitamin B5, this foundation not only provides medium coverage and a natural finish, but also protects and nourishes your skin. And the best part? The blurring sponge tip applicator makes application a breeze. Say goodbye to cakey, uneven foundation, and hello to a flawless, radiant complexion. Try our new foundation today and see the difference for yourself at amazon.com/instant eraser foundation.
everybody. Welcome back. We're joined now by one of our friends. You know him as the host of All In with Chris Hayes on MSNBC. Chris Hayes is joining us, everybody.
How you doing, Seth?
I'm doing very well. Right before we went live with this interview, I was talking with you and your wife. I know that you three kids, two whose school year is over, and you were basically homeschooling. How's that going?
It's, well, I should stipulate that Kate, my wife, has been doing the lion's share of it, but I do have, she basically has 2.5 hours in the day to herself. She's working all day homeschooling, and then she's anchor producing me when I do the show. So she has very long days. So there's 2.5 hours that I have the kids. And, you know, it's, I mean, if I have one more Zoom meeting number or password or app that needs some login, I'm going to lose my mind. And everyone's doing their best and everyone's trying, but like, it's hard. And, you know, it's a lot of work and it's hard to not be distracted, particularly when you've got the show that night.
Yep.
And there's a lot of kind of like, all right, why don't you just go read over?
Yeah. What I think we have something in common, which is when we realized we had to do our shows from home, that we did not have very good internet. Is that true?
Correct. Yes, I had to upgrade to the premium level of internet.
Yeah,
you know, it's a funny thing I've noticed. So we're getting this weird window into people's internet quality through the various Zoom, and there's no predicting. Like some people, like Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, who she and her husband have a fair amount of personal wealth. That's a publicly
reported
thing. Not very good internet last night.
Yeah,
and then I mean, it's like it's crazy how bad American broadband seems to be generally as we're learning throughout this thing, or just how inconsistent it is across various domains.
Yes. And you, when you think about Nancy Pelosi, also, the Bay Area, Silicon Valley.
Yeah, right.
Your mom, like mine, was a teacher. Your father worked at the Department of Health. They seem like very helpful parents to have during a time like this.
They are. I mean, we miss them because like everyone, they're sheltering in place in the home I grew up in the Bronx. So we're doing a lot of FaceTiming with Nana and Papa, and you know, FaceTiming with people, even particularly loved ones, is always a little weird. But they're great. My mom has been offering teaching advice and sort of goals for lessons. My father, I think, was part of the reason that I kind of locked into this story early, was just seeing he had worked in New York City Department of Public Health, which is an incredible institution, has been for literally over a century, just, you know, an amazing place, and handled the Ebola crisis very well. So I think I had sort of learned from him about a certain kind of cast of mind that public health people have, which is they do tend to think worst case scenario. Like there is a kind of, what if this goes wrong? What if this goes sideways thinking that can be hard to come to if you're a generally happy, optimistic person, but I think it's been very helpful for thinking about this.
You were one of the first people to talk about how serious this could get. And I feel as though journalists like yourself had to toe the line between both early reporting and balancing it with the idea of being alarmist. Did you feel at any point that you were screaming into the void in the early days of this?
I did. I mean, I definitely did, particularly the period where it really felt like screaming into the void was when it was clear we had a very sizable, rapidly accelerating outbreak in those first 2 weeks of March, before the real steps happened. Once we had documented community transmission. In February, I think, you know, I had that feeling too. I don't want to freak people out. And I would say, yes, you know, the flu kills a lot of people and the odds of you being hit by this remain relatively low, which was true at the time. But like, if you look at New York now, like New York City, that wouldn't prove to be true in the long run. So yes, to me, the real breaking points are when Dr. Meissonier, the CDC in late February, does that telephone briefing where she says, people should start talking about their schools about teleschooling. And people are like, what? Tell us, what are you talking about? We're gonna shut down schools? And then it was like, 3 weeks later, we've shut down every school. And when she said that, that to me was a trigger of like, oh, we're going where Italy is gone. We're going where Wuhan is gone. Like, we're all sailing to the same destination.
The daily briefings are a circus. A lot has been written and said about whether or not these should even be televised. Are you getting any information for them? Do you feel as though it's fair criticism to say they maybe should be on TV less?
I think the critique to me, the concern I have is that they literally communicate public health information that's wrong or is in contrast or tension with the best available evidence. And that's dangerous, right? I mean, we know there's been a sort of partisan divide about how seriously people take this, how much they're adhering to social distancing, though that's closed quite a bit, which is good. But that to me is the real concern about those. I do think that the briefings as a performance have kind of entered their like Baroque phase, that it's like the writers are out of ideas. And there was a moment yesterday where he was the president of the United States. 2,000 Americans died yesterday. Nearly 30,000 Americans have passed away. The economy is contracting at a Great Depression level. And the president for 3 minutes just read the names of companies.
Yeah.
Like Chick-fil-A. We love Chick-fil-A. McDonald's. Like,
yeah.
And so to me, the more obviously they are ridiculous exercises in his own self-aggrandizement, the weirdly less dangerous they become. The earlier phases felt more dangerous to me because they had the putative frame of being a briefing from the Task Force on Public Health. At this point, it seems to me that it's so obvious that's not what's happening. That's not what's happening.
One of the biggest shifts that is happening as well is this idea of reopening the economy. It seems like, and again, it changes every day. It seems as though the president is fixating on this idea of May 1st. And how much of this do you feel is driven by his fear of a failing economy versus his sense that we're all safe to go back to our lives?
I mean, it's 100% the former. The biggest mistake they made from the beginning, and I talked about this on my show last night, was in the beginning when the problem began to materialize and manifest, and particularly manifest in the stock market, the president clearly thought, I'm going to run for re-election on a great booming economy. And they were explicit about that. That's not like, that's what they said. And now the economy is doing poorly. It's going to hurt my reelection. We need to pump the economy back up. And in the beginning, they were focused on the economy as a somehow separate problem from the public health problem. And the thing experts keep saying is like, no. They're not, you got to deal with the public health problem. You can't just, and eventually I think he was convinced of that and now is going back to the old thinking, which is, okay, now we're going to reopen the economy. It's still the same goddamn virus. It's the same virus that's still circling around. It's still the same thing causing the problems to have us lock down the economy. There's no independent solution to reopening the economy that is independent from a plan to deal with and contain the virus.
We're going to be right back with more Chris Hayes, and I want to talk about the fact that there is an election, even though no one is talking about it. We'll be right back. So, I feel as though the last time you were on, we were talking about the fact that we were pretty quickly going to have a nominee for the Democratic Party and all the news would shift to the horse race of the presidential election. That has not been the case. Is it surreal to you, having covered this from the very beginning, how certainly the Democratic primary resolved itself?
It's so surreal to think about, 15 or 16 months of intense focus. I mean, Kamala Harris's big announcement in the Bay Area with thousands of people and the first debate and the second debate and John Delaney getting his butt kicked by Elizabeth Warren, that all of that converged to a video probably shot on an iPad in the Vermont house of Bernie Sanders, beamed to the world amidst the worst pandemic in 100 years and the economy on total lockdown and half of the world's population essentially it was incomprehensible that this is where it would end up, that this is where it's ended up. And so there's naturally this way in which I think the urgency of the virus is blotting out campaign news, but also it's completely recast the dynamics of the race. I mean, the assumption for those 15 months and through impeachment was the fundamentals are this man is unpopular. He's never been above 50%. He won with 46% of the vote last time, but the economy's doing, in a macro sense, pretty well. What does that mean for the election? That is not the election that we're having anymore. So part of it is I think people haven't even gotten their hands around, I certainly haven't gotten my head around, what is this election? What's the substance of it? Because the future is so uncertain, I don't know what June looks like, and I sure as hell don't know what October looks like.
it did seem as though the party coalesced around the idea of Biden as a candidate as sort of the safest contrast to Donald Trump. Like, maybe not the most idea-driven candidate. Hopefully I'm not being unfair in saying that.
No, I think
and yet now we're in a situation that it is only contrast. It seems as though Joe Biden, who has not necessarily been out as much as you would expect a nominee for the presidency to be out in public, it seems like he's maybe just stepping back and letting people see the contrast.
I think that's part of it. I mean, I do think that, look, one way to think about it is all re-election campaigns are referendums on the incumbent, unavoidably. That dynamic seems like it's going to be supersized in this case. I mean, it's going to be a referendum on the incumbent and his handling of this once a century calamity. And so at a certain level, it's like, it is a, do you want to keep going with this guy or not kind of election. And you have to be present and illuminating your own ideas, I think, as the opposition party and as the opposition candidate. But it's also the case that, like, I think that dynamic fundamentally is a pretty inescapable one at this point.
Can you talk real quick about what happened in Wisconsin? Because, again, I think it got dwarfed, obviously, by pandemic news. But it was a really, truly, first, crazy that the primary was held. And then sort of the outcome seemed to be the reverse of what a lot of people were expecting based on the fact that the election had been held.
It was I found it to be a really upsetting undertaking, like shockingly cynical. The basic dynamics were, and I, you know, back in March 17th, I think were the last big Democratic primary elections. And that things were, it was a little unclear they should have gone forward then. We've since heard the poll worker in Illinois died. By the end, by right up to that, I thought this is not a good idea. But a month later, when everything has dawned on everyone, and we're now all, I'm talking to you, you know, through a computer screen, right? That for the Republicans to think a low turnout, more difficult election will aid their chances of winning a state Supreme Court race. And if you want to vote, then get out there, Milwaukee, and stand in line with a mask is so shockingly cynical and monstrous that I could not believe they did it, but they did it. And then everyone just assumed that those turnout effects would help the Republican, and the Republican kind of got his ass kicked. Like, he lost by 10 points. I mean, Donald Trump won Wisconsin by 23,000 votes. The liberal challenger in this race, who was running against an incumbent, won by over 100,000 votes. I mean, this was a big, big win for the Democrats and liberals broadly in Wisconsin. And I still don't really have my arms around why it happened. We talked to Ben Wickler, the chair of the Democratic Party, last night. I think part of it was people were really furious and pissed off that in the midst of the pandemic, some people were like trying to rig the game against them.
Well, it does seem like a bad bellwether for the Republican Party, but I think, as you referenced earlier, it's impossible to know based on anything that happens this week what that means in June, what that means in October. Do you feel like the Democrats are doing enough right now to protect the election in November?
That's a huge worry, and the answer is probably no, although it's not that they haven't tried, it's that they haven't prioritized it. So there's a fight in the CARES Act, which was the last rescue bill that was passed, over funding for universal mail-in voting. And Democrats, Mitch McConnell's given $100 million, and Democrats wanted $2 billion, and they ended up getting north of $400 million. The problem is, like, it's up to the states in some ways. They need the money from the federal government, but some states aren't probably going to do it because they don't want to do it. So you would probably have to pass some sort of universal mail-in voting required legislation. Ron Wyden and Amy Klobuchar have worked on that. I think it has to be a priority because we don't know what's going to happen in November. Like, there may be a, in 1918, famously, the flu reared its head in the spring. It diminished through the summer, and then it had its worst outbreak that fall. And can you imagine a 50-state version of Wisconsin? I mean, that it would just be both a public health and Democratic legitimacy debacle. It's a nightmare scenario that I think Democrats need to focus much more energy on preventing.
I look forward to you keeping us up to date on all of this. So happy that you're still managing to do your show. Thank you for making time for us today. Chris Hayes, everybody. Check out the show every day.
Great to be on, man.
Late Night with Seth Meyers airs weeknights on NBC at 12:35, 11:35 Central. Original music on the Late Night Podcast is by the HE Band. Don't forget to follow the handle Late Night Seth on social media and tell your friends to subscribe to the Late Night Podcast wherever they get their podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by the effortlessly scrumptious bite of Skinny Pop Popcorn. Imagine this: perfectly popped, endlessly delicious kernels, a symphony of just three simple ingredients: popcorn, sunflower oil, and a sprinkle of salt. No compromise, just pure snacking freedom. And hey, if you're up for a twist, dive into flavors like zesty white cheddar to sweet and salty kettle. Every bite's a delight, light and oh so tasty. Shop Skinny Pop now.